Well, for anybody down south that's online with us today, winter is here in the plains in full force. Very cold outside, but it's warm in here, and it's the Sabbath, and we're all together, so we are blessed. Lots to be thankful for. It's great to be here. And we'll go ahead and get going, continue our series here. Last week, we began looking at the words of Yehovah in chapter 11 of Leviticus. And I asked last week during discussion time if you wanted me to go through the food laws again. And I think it was kind of decided that since I did that other series that it wasn't really necessary. But given the message from last week, I do want to take another run at it. But it's going to be a completely different take. Probably not at all like you might think. Nothing like I've done before. Completely different angle. And in order to do that, truths that are embedded in this. Understanding these concepts goes a long way towards clearing up many confusing doctrinal concepts, not the least of which is this salvation and works question. Because only God, through His sovereign declaration, makes someone holy. In other words, saves them. The world would say saves. And allows them to be in His presence. They would say to be in heaven, right? Okay, and keep from defiling ourselves and have to come out of that state of holiness. But when that happens, again, you can plead the blood of Yeshua, repent, and get back into there. So we need to understand this. When Paul said that by no means should the law be cast out, this is what he's talking about, right? You know, Paul also correctly stated that the law cannot save. The law can't make you holy, right? And it can't. The law can only, you know, keep you clean if you could stay there. I mean, you need Yeshua to clean you up. The law allows you to be able to stay clean, if you will. But it can't make you holy. It can't save you. He was correct in that. And he's also correct when he says, by no means will the law make you holy. It can't. So this is the pattern that Yehovah illustrates over and over for us. For instance, we talk about the holy days revealing God's plan of salvation. And for good reason, because they do. But that's a broad view, an umbrella view, if you will. But there is much more underneath that umbrella, much more of the finer things that, right, clean and unclean. We see this pattern throughout the Torah. The Hebrews lived and understood things in patterns. Guys, it's how they thought, okay? It's how they thought. And this is the point. It was written by Hebrews. All of it. It was all Hebrews, only Hebrews. Now, there's a little bit of debate that maybe Luke might not have been a Hebrew, but you think about Luke's book. It was his amalgamation, if you will, or collection of events and stories and personal experience of Hebrews. So no matter how you slice it, kept coming unplugged. Sorry about that. When we look at these things, we find that a culture is actually embedded in its language, okay? I mean, look at how Americans express things versus other parts of the world. And then even compare that over time. even the same words get different meanings, right? Gay, for example, just a few decades ago meant happy, right? You see, at the Tower of Babel, Yehovah divided and separated one common language of the world into many. And the result of that was far more far-reaching than just people not being able to communicate with each other. What happened was those that could communicate with each other, probably families and tribes, you know, congregated together and ended up kind of moving out into different areas, right? It really accomplishing what God had set forth. It said, go out and you know, cover the earth. So, but in the process of that, each one of those began to develop their own culture, okay? They were divided and separated and isolated, and so they got different philosophies, they got different ideas on morality, different ideas on different concepts on which to operate their culture. And many times those were, there were parts of that, each of those cultures, that were totally unique to that culture. So from there then, the native language of that culture, now understand this, the native language of that culture then began to develop words that only applied to that, to those unique characteristics of that particular culture. Right? So the point is that language and culture that it represents often have concepts that are very difficult to communicate to anyone outside of that culture for two reasons. One, there are no words that have been invented in the other culture to express that uniqueness that's in the other one, because there's no reason to make a word. And two, it's possible that certain concepts, again, only exist within that one culture in the first place. So naturally, there would be no reason for another culture to come up with language to describe it. I read this week that, I didn't know this, in Spanish, there's three words for love. And I'm told that it's almost impossible to translate those words over into English because they are aspects of love that are unique to the to those people, to that culture. And that's the kind of things that, that make it very difficult to do these translations. And this is the crux of the problem when we're trying to understand this Bible. When trying to understand what these words meant to the people in that culture, right? To those ancient Hebrew people. Rather than what they simply say when they're translated over into a different language in a different culture. It gets pretty complex pretty quick. And now, it gets worse based on what I alluded to earlier, because here we go. Hebrew culture also revolved around a way of thinking. A way of thinking. We don't even think about ways of thinking. And it was a way of thinking that was very common in that area. And the way information was mentally processed was naturally reflected in their language. So you have a Hebrew language and it's reflective of this way that they processed information, the way they thought, okay? And what I mean by way of thinking is not about humans often put different emphasis on or importance on different matters or priorities or things like that. It's not. Rather, it's the style of thinking. And it was entirely different. It was how conclusions are arrived at, how things are processed. See, today the vast majority of the world, certainly the Western world, uses a style of thinking that does not even appear to have even existed prior to the Greeks popularizing it around 450 BC. It didn't even exist. It's that Greek style of processing information and forming conclusions that now the bulk of the world, particularly the developed world, uses today. And we have to understand, it is vastly different from the way things were in Bible times in the, with the Hebrew people. And everybody in this room, and all of the translators of the Bible, going back to its very first translation, they all think in this Greek fashion. Scholars call it the rational, logical style. It's how we think. Even women, okay, don't think it's just logic and, you know, no. Even women, emotions are even processed with this style, whether you realize it or not. But with the biblical Hebrews, from before Moshe up to including those at the time of Yeshua, did not think this way. They didn't think this way. They did not think in a rational, logical style. Rather, they operated in what was what scholars call analogic. And I'll explain that in a minute. But what this means for us is that often when Hebrew writers of the Bible write something, and what they meant is obscured by the difficulty of attempting to translate analogic Hebrew thought into modern day Western thought, and trying to do that with a rational, logic based language. So you've got a language barrier and a way of thinking barrier, and I just want to peel this onion back a little bit and really explain the significant difference between analogic thought, which was the original writers of the Bible, and the rational logic thought of the Bible interpreters and us. We need to do this because it directly corresponds to the patterns that we see in the Torah, and to be able to understand them. Let's first define this rational logical thought. This is a style of thinking that we all unconsciously use because it's how we've grown up. It's everything in our society is built around it. We've probably never even been exposed to anything else, any alternative style of thinking, and even if we did, we probably wouldn't even recognize it, because most of our modern culture, most of the world's cultures, reflects this rational, logical thought, and it has for 2,000 years. Now, there are some Orientals that still have some analogical thought to a degree in their cultures. It's why businessmen struggle a lot to do business, because, you know, sometimes the thinking just doesn't line up. But the point is that rational logical thought is by no means universal. And here's the other point. It's not better either. It's not more advanced than analogical thought. It's just different, and it's practically opposite. It's not something that we made a conscious effort to choose to think in one style or another. It's just present in everything around us and taught in our culture. We see it in science, right? The scientific method that we learn in elementary school, you know, where there's a cause and effect, that everything exists as part of a larger system, and every system is structured so that we can break it apart. See, we get very analytical, we get very logical, and we break these things apart. I go to cars a lot for analogies, and you can think about a car, and it's got, it's a system. A car is a system, but it has a bunch of little systems, doesn't it? You kind of break it apart. It's got an engine, it's got a body, it's got an electrical system, it's got, you know, doors and whatever. Okay, and you can break those things apart, and you can build one each individually. You can even take an engine and you can put it in something else, and you can make a boat or an airplane, right? But if you take that engine and you put all these other things with it, then you have a car. It's that kind of compartmentalized, you know, logical thing. We do it in the medical industry, I call it, right? In medicine. Right? What do we have? We have a skeletal system. We have a nervous system. We have an immune system. We have all, you know, that's what we do. Logically, we break it all apart. And we have doctors that are specializing in each one of those things. Okay? And so this type of thought is broken down generally into two types of reasoning. It's called inductive and deductive. So deductive reasoning operates on cold facts and just adds them up. So deductive reasoning says, fact one, all dogs have four legs. Fact two, Rover's a dog. So the conclusion is Rover has four legs. Now that's simple enough. But inductive reasoning, that's where we kind of get in trouble, does not seek to achieve this same type of certainty, right? Rather, inductive reasoning gathers bits and pieces of information together and combines it with our life experiences and our knowledge and tries to come to an observation about what seems to be true. This is an example of inductive reasoning. Observation one, John came to class late this morning. Observation two, John's hair was messy. Experience says that John's hair is usually neat and combed. And the conclusion was John must have woken up late, right? You can begin then to see the limitations. When we observe people and we deal with people, we tend to use inductive reasoning in making our conclusions. And so whether it's deductive or inductive, it is all still based on rational, logical thinking. In other words, it's linear and evolutionary. A leads to B, B to C, that sort of thing. This type of thinking always asks why. Remember that. Why? Rational, logical thought says that history is a straight line and it's non-repeating, that the past doesn't necessarily predict the future. That's why we make the same mistakes over and over again. Patterns are not analyzed from a historical standpoint. When I was studying for this, I found this statement, and I think it says it well. It says, the thing about rational logical thinking is that it operates best in a vacuum, away from relationships and connections to other things that might be similar or that happened previously. Truth and relevance are pragmatic. That is, in the rational logical thinking style, the question of why something happened is defined by how it happened and exactly what happened. It's a very narrow search for relevant information because it pertains to a specific event at a specific time. The past and the future have no relevance to one another and little, if any, relevance to the current situation. End quote. That's Greek thinking. That's Greek thinking. And in a few minutes, you'll see why that type of thinking simply does not have a clue what to do with the Hebrew style of thought, analogic thought. Before I go through that, though, I want to, again, really express that there isn't anything wrong or ungodly, per se, nor faulty about the rational logic thought style, so long as you acknowledge that it's not the only style of thinking, and we acknowledge that it has built-in limitations. For instance, the universe as created by Yehovah doesn't necessarily always act in a rational, logical way. This type of thinking is very man-centered. It's totally dependent on analyzing our four dimensions, you know, and what is observable. And, you know, many believe that if you can't scientifically observe it and test it, it isn't real. And God doesn't exist in that. This type of thinking relies on the power of the human mind to discover, and then to use those discoveries to make decisions and judgments. In other words, what can't be proved by logic and reason is automatically invalid. See, you can see serious limitations in that, right? Now, analogic thinking is an entirely different thing. And it takes a little bit to wrap your mind around this. It operates on established patterns and previous models. Analogic thinking searches for and it recognizes common foundational truths that are shared between similar things. Even though those particular smaller things may not be exactly alike. You know, it's a bad example, but you think about the wing of an airplane. It can be compared to the wings of a bird. Well, there's hardly nothing similar about the two, you know, except for they both have things that stick out from the side. Okay, but the same principle of aerodynamics works in both, doesn't it? Analogic thinking relies on these types of relationships and connections. Have you noticed? We're up to Leviticus 11, chapter 11. Have you noticed so far that most of the times the Torah does not give a logical, rational reason for the given laws and instructions? It doesn't offer them most of the time. See, what we usually get is another but similar law or instruction added. And then we get another, and then another. And see, in analogic thinking, the relationship between all these laws and instructions creates an overall picture that then gives the meaning. So, when we ask ourselves questions like, why can't I eat pork? The beginning perspective should be, well, because it conforms to the underlying principle behind all the other laws. It's one more layer for the purpose of staying in perfect relationship to all the other rules. Analogic thought style would not ask that question. The Hebrews did not ask that question. They would look at that and they would say, what other principles or law is this aligned with? They would get illumination that way. And you can understand Yeshua spoke this way. Yeshua was Hebrew. This was how he communicated too. He taught in these analogical thought style parables. Embodied in each of them were spiritual principles and patterns that exist and never change. He got his point across by applying principles of established and understood patterns to other things that didn't on the surface even seem similar. Sometimes those dissimilarities are so big that people had and still have trouble understanding them. I mean, and why? Because they didn't understand the pattern, right, that was behind it, that connected it all. What does a mustard seed have to do with the kingdom of heaven? Why would anybody throw valuables to a pig, right? What does keeping oil in a lamp have to do with the return of Yeshua? The answer is in long-established patterns and principles.
See, the thing about analogic thinking is that it must have a pre-existing pattern from which to go from. Again, it's building. It boils down to this. The important issue in analogical thinking, this style, is which pattern is true and relevant to the current situation. That's how they would look at things. When things happen, they would say, what's this relevant to? How does it apply? How does what we've seen in the past truths apply to this? You see, in the Greek style of thinking, the search is always for why. But in the Hebrew style, the biblical style of thinking, the search is always for which. Which? Which previous pattern fits the current regulation or circumstance? It's there. That's where the meaning is, and the reason, if you will, becomes clear for them. And guys, the Bible is written that way. But translated, trying to use rational logic and rational-based language and culture to explain it. And it's a problem. And so it's with this perspective that there are different styles of thinking that apply practically to our study of Torah. Not only do we not process things the way they did, we may not even have the words to represent those thoughts in our current rational, logic-based language. Hebrew was a separate culture with a completely unique language designed to communicate Hebrews' unique cultural concepts. And so God communicated to them that way. Greek, on the other hand, is a widespread and variant culture with a unique language that was designed to communicate its particular culture and principles. Okay? And so we have to ask, how does a Greek system of thinking and problem solving, this rational, logical thinking, how does it extract truth and meaning from an entirely opposite way of thinking? How do Hebrews, how do these concepts of theirs that existed only in their minds, how does that get communicated to men like us who dwell in a Greek culture? Well, the short answer is it's not very good. It doesn't work very good. Now, is Hebrew somehow good and Greek somehow bad? Is Hebrew godly and Greek ungodly? No, not at all. Because why? Because God intentionally, purposefully, he forced language variation, didn't he? He did it on purpose, right? So the other thing that you think about is God also knew clearly and allowed that the next testament would be written in Greek. Now, why would he do that? Personally, I think it's because he had already revealed all the principles in the Hebrew. He's already revealed them. And that's why you can't go into the Greek Second Testament and understand a lick of it, because it's written in that Greek style of thinking, that it translated that way, written that way, and it's based on these analogic Hebrew principles and concepts. You can't understand that you can't understand the second one without the first one. It's impossible, because you'll use your logic, reasoning, rational stuff to, as I've said many times, make stuff up. So as we look at Torah, and currently Leviticus, what we need to be looking for is patterns and models. What answers are available to us will only come through recognizing patterns established by Yehovah. See, it's the rational, logical thinking that seeks bottom line answers. We just want bottom line answers. Analogical thought seeks a familiar pattern. And so we have to be very careful of asking why. Why individual laws and commands are as they are. Why some things that Yehovah created, he said, were clean and others unclean. That answer is not necessarily found for looking for scientific, rational, logical answers. The answers are found in the principles contained within the patterns that God created starting in Genesis 1. The answers are not found in the reasoning of our minds, validated in proofs and results, cause and effect. And there's some of that, yes, but the answers, the true answers, are found by trusting that Yehovah created everything, that he operates in a way that is unchanging according to these patterns, and everything works in harmony and is revealed in those patterns. And the reality is that our minds, growing up the way we have, are simply not built to understand this. We're not built to understand God's mind. Now that statement there is probably in complete disharmony with the way that we think. And so it's led to some of the worst sort of wrong-minded allegory that has been taught to people, taught to the saints by well-meaning Bible translators. Because again, those translators are using the same kind of rational, you know, logical thought patterns. And by the way, those people also were completely anti-Jewish, but we won't go there. So what they wanted to know in translating this stuff is they wanted to know why. Why did they want to know why? Because that's the basis of Greek thinking. The search for why is at the heart of logical, rational thought. Yet you won't find that theme of this ongoing search for why in the Bible. What you find is faith. What you find is trust. You find is watch what I've done and follow it. Except in the rarest of occasions, why was simply not a question that people asked about God's laws and commands. I'm running a little long, so I'm going to just say this very quickly. One other thing about asking why is because it's not compatible with having faith. Listen, if we could always find out why, where's the faith? I mean, you look at Job, right? Job could have asked why. If God would have told Job why, he would have understood it right away. There wouldn't have been any need for faith. Well, he had all his friends come, and they were trying to tell him why. Gave him bad advice. Every single one of them was wrong in their guesses. But where would he have been had he known why? Right? I have come to realize, guys, that I need to abandon that search for why and instead look at some of the most basic patterns and models that the Torah establishes to get us to try to think that way. It's hard, but we can be encouraged by some of the things we already know. Everything about the system of sacrifice follows a model that we see established as early as the garden. It gets expanded and clearer at Mount Sinai, and it gets expanded again at Wilderness Tabernacle. I did a whole, at least one whole message, I think it was a series of messages on the tabernacle and how each one of the things was the pattern that showed Yeshua's work. It was also a pattern, if you'll remember, I talked about the three levels of holiness that was established on Mount Sinai. You had the Holy of Holies, where only Moshe went to. Okay? Within the tabernacle, you had the Holy of Holies, where the high priest only went once a year. Then you had the holy place, halfway down the mountain, where the elders and everybody came up. They could come in there, just like the priest could come in to the holy place. And then you had the lower level, where the fence was. That was the courtyard, where the people could come in. See, you had these three layers of holiness. It's the pattern just just goes and repeats over and over again. The pattern carries further and applies to the structure of the priesthood, doesn't it? The high priest is the only one that can go into the Holy of Holies. And then you have the other priests, the common priests that could be in the holy place, but not in the Holy of Holies. And then you had all the Levites that were separated out, and they could be in the courtyard attending to the priests. Okay? So again, the priesthood, a pattern of these of three layers of holiness. This was even projected upon the sacrifices itself. If you look at the olah sacrifice, the parts of the body were to be separated and put on the altar in a certain order. Don't have time to go through all that, but you actually see kind of a stacking of these parts. You had the body, the head, the entrails, the organs. The head, and so each one of those, it just stacked up, and the entrails, right, is the innermost part, right? Well, that was the most holy part, and it was at the top, right? If you're putting these things on the altar one at a time, right? It's another pattern of these of the three levels of holiness. They just repeat over and over again. And so the answer that they would not have answered, they would not have asked why. Why, God, are you putting that on there? Why do we have to do it in that order? They wouldn't have asked that. They would have looked at that and they would have said, what does that match up to? What is it teaching us? What is it showing us? And so it would show them that those things have been consecrated, they've been made holy, and those certain things are rising to the presence of God, just like everything else. This is analogic thinking. This is the thinking style of the Hebrews. The answer to why is because it all conforms to God's ordained patterns. Now, sometimes we do see logic and reason within some things. And in conjunction with Leviticus 11, a big example is the food laws. Study can show us that meat of unclean animals is harmful to the human body. Our bodies, our digestive system is not made to effectively process it. Okay? It's not food, which I've covered. Quick aside, I shared this with Sherilyn. I did learn this week that a lobster is the only animal on the planet that urinates out of its face. Can't make this up. How gross is that? I mean, it's not food, right? It's not food. So things like that can help us understand, right? It can help us understand, even logically. But what if we didn't have those facts? My point is, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. What we really should be looking for is not why can't we eat it, but which pattern does it apply to? What is Yehovah showing us? What is he building on? What are we to make of these ritual purity laws as it concerns food? Well, at least the beginning of that answer comes in verse 44 of Leviticus 11. Where he says, "For I am the Lord your God, you shall therefore consecrate yourselves, and you shall be holy, set apart, as I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourself." Ugh, don't defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Now think about that in context of what we learned last week. Leviticus 11:47, to distinguish between the unclean and the clean, and between the animal that may be eaten and the animal that may not be eaten. Its purpose is to distinguish between the clean and the unclean. God made some animals for food, and he distinguished them from other animals to constantly teach us about holiness. while eating nourishing food and avoiding other bad stuff is beneficial, the primary purpose for Yehovah's establishment of the dietary laws is all about holiness. If we want to comprehend these kosher eating requirements, we can begin by adopting the mind of the Hebrew biblical writer, which means that our only hope is to search for the which God-ordained pattern applies to food. A pattern or patterns that connect to the Lord's clean and unclean designations. We already have established one pattern that Yehovah created for mankind, and this pattern was really created by employing one of the most basic, you know, governing dynamics that God uses to deal with this. And that is division, election, and separation. We've talked about that. We've talked about that in this series. Mankind this day this screams about unity. The church wants it at all costs. Yet God over and over again makes sovereign elections. He divides, he separates. And here again, with the food laws, he's separating. He's separating. From a perspective of holiness, as concerns the eating of animals, we have clean animals, which can be eaten by God's people. They can be in the camp of God's people. And he separated out unclean animals, which are not to be eaten by Israel. And they must be outside the camp of Israel from a food purpose standpoint. Sacrificial animals are those that may be presented to Yehovah by the priests, right? To move from that common clean state to holy. Those are sacrificed animals, okay? And they can only be the clean ones. The unclean ones can't be sacrificed. Why? Because they're unclean. Just like we learned. I just take this full circle. Do you see how this fits the pattern? All the animals are common. Some are clean and some are unclean as declared by Yehovah. It's his decision. He made them all. He made them all common. He said some are clean, some are unclean. Now, as God's people, if we consume an unclean animal, Leviticus 11:44 said, don't defile yourself. We don't want to be over here. We want to stay here with the help, obviously, of Yeshua. Okay? But we can see how the pattern fits with the sacrifice and with holiness. Yehovah declared some animals clean. Those can be inside the tabernacle. Those animals can be inside the temple. Does that fit in anything, guys? Who's the temple? Where's the temple? Where the temple? Are unclean animals supposed to be in the temple? No. Period. I don't care if it's the most succulent, nourishing food on the planet Earth. God said, that is not to be in my temple. I'm not making that holy. You are holy. Therefore, be holy as I am holy. We read that too. You see? You are the temple. Unclean animals are not allowed in the temple. In the tabernacle, in the courtyard, in the temples that were built later, and in us now. Only the clean animals are eligible to be in God's presence. He declared it. He is sovereign. The others are not. They're defiled. Period. End of discussion. So, to God's people, to Israelites, to people who have God's Spirit, whose dwelling place is God's Spirit,
all of these discussions. You can talk about whether they ate meat before the flood or after the flood, or you know, after the flood the meat was given, or and then Peter's faith. You can talk about that till you're all blue in the face, and you can use all the reason and rational thinking that you care to employ, and none of it gives it's all moot, every last bit of it, because God ordained his pattern and he declared these things clean and unclean, what can be in his presence and what cannot. End of discussion. So you see, Hebrew thinking says, which pattern? What does it mean? Here it is. If you are cleaned up by the blood of Yeshua and made common clean, you are made then holy by a sovereign God, and you're sanctified as his temple and dwelling place. And whether it's something good or not is a moot point, because you don't want to go back to being unclean again, do you? And didn't it say that we are to be a daily sacrifice? You can't, you know, that unclean animals were not sacrificed. They're not allowed in God's presence. You can't be clean and consume unclean things. It's a principle. But you can understand that while this be, see, the purity laws in this five chapters begins with this thing about food, but it's the beginning. It's just the beginning. It's just the start. Remember, verse 44 said, "You are to be holy, for I am holy." The pattern is that the animals which can be sacrificed on the altar for atonement come from the same exact group of animals. And that Hebrew word is I forgot to look up how it's pronounced, Behama, B-E-H-E-M-A-H, Behama, I'm going to pronounce it that way. And that word is for clean, domesticated land animals, the animals from which Israel can eat. Now, Yehovah only sacrifices and accepts spiritually of the same clean animals that he told Israel they could eat physically. Now, the relationship of holiness between mankind and sacrificed animals extends even further. I want to read you the commandment to you concerning the Sabbath. Exodus 20, verse 10. "But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle," there it is, "or your stranger who is within your gates." In this version, we read the word cattle. Other versions simply say animals. Isn't it interesting that the Sabbath includes animals as well as man? But hidden in here, okay, is in the original Hebrew words and mindset of the passage, is this word, and it's obscured by our logic thinking and our necessity to have to translate this over into that sort of language, and it just hides what this is, the deeper meaning that this has, because this word here, wherever it is, cattle, guess what word it is? Behama. Behama. It's referring to clean, domesticated animals. He's made a covenant. You get that? This is a covenant. He's made a covenant with these clean animals. Does it surprise you that God would make a covenant with animals? It shouldn't. It's not the first time. Genesis 9, this is when he was speaking to Noah, and I'm going to drop down here. It says that, in verse 9 it says, "I am establishing a covenant with you and your descendants," and verse 10, "with every living creature that is with you."
So he's made covenants with animals before, in this case, never to destroy them again with a flood. And right there in the midst of the what we call the Ten Commandments, he makes a covenant with the animals, with the clean animals, that they should also receive a Sabbath rest. And it's only for the behemoth. Only for the behemoth. This was for all the animals. But in the Sabbath deal, it was only for the clean animals. So just tell me, try to tell me that God doesn't divide and he doesn't separate, because he does. Within this, right here, guys, we get the picture about the spiritual pattern regarding the law of clean and unclean land animals. God declared some clean and divided the unclean away from his holiness. Verse 44 clearly stated that to consume the unclean animals defiles you, makes you unclean. And this is just spiritual holiness. It's a holiness issue for Israel, of which we are. They were and we are set apart to be holy as he is holy. Let those that are outside the camp, let them eat it all they want. They're unclean anyway. If God brings them in and they accept Yeshua and they really are following him and earnestly seeking after him, then Yeshua will clean them up and move them into that clean category, and this would be part of that growth process. But they're unclean. If they want to be inside the camp, if they want to be inside the tabernacle, inside the holy place, inside the presence of God, they have to do it according to the pattern that God set forth in his sovereignty to do so. And so we continue to see these patterns. Yehovah is dominant over man, just as man is dominant over all the other living creatures. Yehovah sets certain people apart for holiness, just as he sets certain animals apart for holiness. They go together. He watches over us, Yehovah does. He just like a shepherd would watch over the sheep and give his life for them. Same thing, see? Same thing. Let me just drop down through here. Again, this whole section that we're into, Leviticus 11 through what is it, 16. It's these purity laws, the purity of the sanctuary, the tabernacle, and the holiness of Yehovah are protected by only permitting sanctified men and sanctified animals into his holy presence. You can't bring unclean animals into the temple and take that before Yehovah. It's just fitting that sanctified men and women are not partaking of defiled animals. It's the same pattern. So the bottom line to all of this is this. In our logical, rational style of thinking, we can ask why we shouldn't eat unclean animals. And yes, as I've taught in the past, we can uncover a host of logical reasons, valid reasons. I stand behind that. There's nothing, they are valid. The problem with doing that and doing that only, and not asking the Hebrew question, which, and retraining our thinking, is that we miss the depth, we miss the reason, the purpose, the connection between that and a myriad of other things that just continues to make God bigger and bigger and bigger in how he orchestrates his whole entire plan and all these fine little details. we completely miss the spiritual implications of understanding and dwelling in the holiness of a sovereign God. Amen.
Amen.